Welcome to Medication Talk, the official podcast of TRC Healthcare, home of pharmacist letter, prescriber insights, RX advanced, and the most trusted clinical resources. On today's episode, we'll discuss management of type 2 diabetes, including overcoming hurdles with metformin, GLP-1 agonists, and SGLT2 inhibitors. Our featured panelist today is Dr. Craig Williams from the Oregon Health and Science University. You'll also hear practical advice from another panelist on TRC's editorial advisory board, Dr. Andrea Darby Stewart from the University of Arizona College of Medicine, Phoenix. This podcast is an extract from one of TRC's monthly live CE webinars. Each month, experts and frontline providers discuss and debate evidence-based practice recommendations. The full webinar originally aired on February 20th, 2024.
And now, the CE information.
This podcast offers continuing education credit for pharmacists, physicians, and nurses. Please log into your pharmacist letter or prescriber insights account and look for the title of this podcast in the list of available CE courses. None of the speakers have anything to disclose. Now, let's join TRC editor, Dr. Jeff Langford, and start our discussion.
We're talking about diabetes treatment update. As we navigate this discussion today, I'd really like to start by pulling the lens back a bit and looking broadly at type 2 diabetes management, including a treatment overview, thinking about choosing first-line medications, and then we'll dive into some of those problem-solving tips, including for metformin, as well as overcoming some common hurdles that are arising in practice with GLP-1 agonist, and we're going to dig into managing and reducing the risk of ketoacidosis with SGLT2 inhibitors. This is kind of popping up against a background of evolving guidelines. So early in the year, annually, we get new guidance from American Diabetes Association, and we have that for 2024. But we also have recent guidance last year from American College of Clinical Endocrinologists, the recent guidance from the VA Department of Defense, and older guidance, 2018, from American College of Physicians. So when as these guidelines emerge from different bodies, that always creates questions about which to follow and sometimes discrepancies across practice. And one area that does align nicely across these recommendations that we can continue to emphasize for our patients is lifestyle change. And so we do want to continue to emphasize as the foundation for management of type 2 diabetes, weight loss where it's needed for our patients, healthy eating, managing sleep and mood, smoking cessation if appropriate, getting healthy movement in, and limiting alcohol. And kind of the next area that is also consistent across guidance is individualization of A1C goals. And Andrea, I'd like to pull you in here to talk to us a little bit about this and perhaps how you do this in your practice.
Sure, that's a great question. One of the first things that we talk about is whether or not the patient has experienced any comorbidities already related to diabetes. We talk about diabetes as really a long game against kidney disease, a cardiovascular disease, and ensuring that the patients can live a very long and healthy life. Patients' age and life expectancy certainly play into that, so I'm much more likely to negotiate a stricter A1C in my younger patients who have not experienced any comorbidities, and can follow directions well, are at less risk for hypoglycemia, than I am in some of my elderly patients who may have already had some of the significant adverse events associated with diabetes. And I'm really trying to mitigate their risk of the adverse effects of the medications I'm using to help keep them relatively euglycemic and prevent just some of the symptoms that are related to significant hyperglycemia.
Well, I love that theme of individualization throughout all of those conversations. Craig, I'd like to move to thinking about the medications, specifically wondering if you can step us through the medications that are now considered first line for management.
It's almost easier in this era to think about like what is not definitely a first line. So I think unless you have a type 1 diabetes patient, we're rarely reaching for insulin first line, but that's certainly it's a wonderful medication when we need it, and we get almost anybody really close to their goal, optimize the insulin, but that can be challenging and carries the biggest risk of hypoglycemia. So, and sulfonylureas have definitely kind of fallen down the list, but lots of things have come up. So as you see illustrated here, historically, and not that long ago, it was kind of metformin, first line. But as we are now getting into maybe the sixth or seventh year of getting outcomes trials for the newer classes of medications, where the FDA decided it's no longer sufficient to just show that you provide glycemic control, you need to show other benefits as well. So we're, again, had many trials now where we're looking at outcomes besides just glycemic control. And those trials have kind of been elevating some of these newer classes of medications. So yes, very much in a way, besides metformin, which still can certainly remain a first-line drug for a lot of patients with certain comorbidities, it really is now the GLP-1s and the SGLT2s that have kind of floating to the surface.
With that in mind, let's turn to metformin. And in our content, we have talked about metformin and often said that it still remains a first-line option for many patients. And can you describe for us kind of some of the advantages or reasons it would still have that kind of gold standard label for so many patients, Craig?
Yeah, I mean, it has been around for a long time. So in fact, it's, you know, it's kind of late to the game here in the US. The Europeans were using it for a couple decades before we were using it. So, you know, we're not going to find some new skeletons in the closet for metformin. And it got kind of unfortunately tagged with the lactic acidosis risk. The risk there is much lower than we kind of thought, and much, much lower than fenformin, its kind of chemical precursor. So it has a safety profile that really is pretty hard to beat. So it's been around for a long time. It's, as a consequence of being around for a long time, it is generically available, has been generically available for a long time. So it's an inexpensive way to get a safe drug. And it, again, does not cause, I'd say, significant and certainly severe hypoglycemia by the way it works. You know, it was really kind of the first major oral drug besides sulfonylureas that where we could get, you know, pretty good A1C effects, and we didn't have this hypoglycemia risk that kind of came inherent with all the sulfonylureas. So it's inexpensive, it's safe, it doesn't cause severe hypoglycemia, and then maybe one strike against it is, I think it does not necessarily improve vascular outcomes like these newer medicines are proving to do. So,
all right. And of course, we do have to, as always, as we think through meds, we're going to consider the limitations or downsides with drugs as well. And we know that metformin does commonly cause GI upset. It carries the warnings, as you mentioned, Craig, for rare lactic acidosis. And we do have to be mindful about using it appropriately in kidney disease, which we'll unpack in a bit. But I want to focus on that GI upset first, Andrea. And in some of our content in the past, we've said that about 1 in 3 patients with type 2 diabetes who start metformin stop it within 3 months. So against that backdrop, I'm kind of wondering how you set expectations for your patients about starting metformin. What should they expect? How can we make it a success for them?
That's a great question. I actually set them up to tell them you're going to experience GI side effects. Okay. You might feel bloated. You might get some diarrhea. If we can start at a low dose, something as simple as 500 milligrams once a day. And once you're tolerating that for 4 to 5 days, maybe even slower, we'll increase that slowly to a maximum dose of 1,000 twice daily. And if that doesn't work, or if you start to get symptoms at any point, we'll just back off to the dose that didn't cause you those symptoms. I basically lay a plan out for them ahead of time so that they don't initially feel after a couple of days of taking the medication lousy and just write it off as ineffective and something that they're, quote, allergic to or intolerant of.
Okay, great. And Craig, and as Andrea painted out that picture of the starting low, going slow, stepping them up carefully with that, I'd like also your thoughts on the product that you choose for that initiation. We've recommended in the past to use an extended release product to help improve tolerability. I wonder if you align with that.
Yeah, but only by a little bit. So, okay. You know, the benefit of metformin is one of the big benefits is it's inexpensive and generic and available to almost everybody. That's a little less true for the extended release version, but it is generally still pretty inexpensive and pretty well covered. So it is a bit better. And if it's available to patients, it's certainly as effective and would not be a wrong strategy to try. But Andrea's comments are well taken of some warning to patients. Although, as we talk about with our, you know, pharmacy students and pharmacy residents, the more you set someone up that something's going to happen, the more you kind of plant that seed it's going to happen. So we have good discussions around how much do you warn about the muscle side effects with statins to, you know, scare people off. And this maybe falls in that category, but it is common enough. I think it is fair to warn about, so not caught off guard. But then kind of my second sentence besides you're going to get some GI upset is going to be mild and you're going to be fine with it. You know, kind of set them up for that second success. But yeah, starting low, there's no rush to this. Diabetes is a long-term condition. We're managing long-term comorbidities. And if it takes you a few months to start ramping up the dose of metformin, that's okay.
Well, Craig, you already noted that lactic acidosis is rare with metformin. And we mentioned that we can use it appropriately in kidney disease, but we do need to be mindful of that appropriate use so that we're keeping that risk very low. And I wondered if you could talk about kind of your approach for dosing metformin or using metformin in patients with kidney disease.
Yeah, I think what you have here on the slide is certainly fair. So I was kind of glad to help in the effort a bunch of years ago to get the labeling for it changed from certain serum creatinine cutoffs for use to the GFR, estimated GFR cutoffs for use. And yeah, you know, below 30 is still the fair number to keep in mind. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, estimated GFR of 31, you're all good, and estimated GFR of 29 is a huge problem. So these are all kind of rough guesstimate equations as we use them in practice. But yeah, if you're going to kind of keep one number in mind to practice with, it is 30.
Let's dive in now. We've talked about solving some common problems with metformin, but let's turn to the GLP-1 agonist class. We have dulaglutide, a couple of different formulations of exenatide, liraglutide, semaglutide, and for purposes of conversation today, we've lumped tirzepatide in this conversation. It's a dual agonist, of course, a GLP-1 and GIP agonist, but we're going to include it here today so to round out our discussion since it is partially a GLP-1 agonist. And Craig, I wonder if as we turn to this class, if you can walk us through the, again, you like that pharmacology hat, so I'm going to use it tonight and ask you to walk us through mechanism of action here and talk a little bit about that.
As we've kind of said, alluded to, it's complicated, but the parts we well understand and what they were developed from was a hormone that really kind of slows gastric emptying and helps improve early satiety in patients. So like the bottom line is they help patients consume fewer calories for a couple reasons, one of which we understand well, which is delayed gastric emptying, and the other which we don't understand too well, which is this complex communication between the gut and the brain that determine when we feel hungry and when we feel sated. So those two together account for just less caloric consumption among our patients. And discussions early on were how much was it the GI upset from these medications that made patients eat less? But then we figured out, no, it's not just GI upset. Patients that don't get GI upset still get the weight loss benefits.
Okay, so brain, gut, and pancreas kind of working together, getting that blood glucose lowered and getting some weight loss in there, as you mentioned as well. But as we already have nodded to, the potential benefits with the GLP-1 agonist don't really stop with just this glycemic management or even the weight loss piece. We do have other considerations and other potential benefits with them. And wondered if you would talk to us a little bit about those benefits, Craig. We've suggested them already, but let's just recap again what goes beyond the A1C lowering with this class.
Yeah, so you're getting into like vascular effects that we still are kind of working. I mean, we know quantitatively they happen. We're still trying to figure out kind of qualitatively exactly how and why they happen. So remember to kind of put our complications still into the kind of macrovascular and microvascular kind of camps. And these drugs have effects on both. And for that chronic kidney disease in particular, yeah, there's benefits there that I'd say we certainly do not understand with this drug class like we do with the SGLT2s, but it is persistent across trials. Whether you define it as acute kidney injury or progression of serum creatinine during the trials, there is benefit there. So it's really the one big, what I would kind of call microvascular benefit of the GLPs. And then the macrovascular is still just atherosclerosis and the consequent MI, stroke, and heart failure risks. And so, yeah, across the board.
What we have seen with these drugs is that A1C lowering is kind of varies across the class. I think it starts around 1%, perhaps for shorter acting drugs like exenatide, goes up to maybe 2%+ for our more potent and longer acting agents like semaglutide and tirzepatide. And then kind of encapsulated here on this slide, Craig, are some of the benefits you've been highlighting that we've seen in those outcome studies. In particular, dulaglutide, semaglutide, and liraglutide have all shown a reduction in cardiovascular events with those three agents, as well as renal benefits. And we do have the three agents in this class that are approved specifically for weight loss, the liraglutide, tirzepatide, and semaglutide. So we can, I think, based on the information you've shared with us, it's reasonable for us to keep these drugs in mind for patients with cardiovascular disease or high risk, certainly for the as an option for chronic kidney disease patients, and certainly for diabetes when weight loss is important. Well, I think one of the issues with these drugs, so we're talking about benefits and reasons we would like to use them. Of course, shortages have plagued our pharmacists, prescribers, and patients in terms of trying to get these GLP-1 agonists. And we've said in our content that we can expect these shortages to continue due to high demand for the foreseeable future. And a couple of different approaches that we might could investigate or consider for any given patient. One would be to temporarily lower the dose, perhaps change GLP-1 agonist, or even switch to a different med class altogether, even if temporarily, to kind of navigate through that shortage. And I think out of that list, the one that would probably raise the most questions for many of our listeners would be how to change GLP-1 agonist. And I wonder if you'll help us with that, Craig, in thinking through perhaps a practical approach if we need to switch agents, and particularly if we're thinking about this context of shortages. Our decision-making might be different for somebody that isn't tolerating it or has other reasons to change, but if it's simply that we can't get it, what would be some practical things to hit on here?
We can look at average typical dosing and say, you know, this is kind of a typical mid-range dose. I do think that, you know, for the most part, we're coalescing around kind of a weekly injection most commonly. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I'd be pretty unexcited as someone on a weekly agent to go to something that's you know, daily, more frequent. So, but yeah, sticking with the weekly injection for those that are on a weekly. And then if it is a matter of converting back, I know we have a slide coming up where we kind of give what we think are equivalent doses. I do think if a patient is tolerating a mid-range dose of an agent, general, they will probably tolerate mid-range dose of the other agent. So I don't think you have to go back to a beginning titrating dose of that agent. But if an abundance of precaution is your approach, you don't know for sure that their GI experience will be the same with agent number two as it was with agent number one. So never bad advice to go back to a starting dose if you do have to switch agents. But our experience has been, if you're tolerating kind of a good mid-range dose you've highlighted there, you can probably jump to that dose with a newer agent. And as Andrew said, this is individualization, and history tends to predict history here. So if you had that patient that started off great and had a smooth titration, you're probably going to be fine. So don't feel like you have to start the whole titration over again with drug number two would be my take home.
Okay, well, let's turn and think about some side effects that go with this class and some limitations, again, that we need to have top of mind if we're going to consider using them. And we've noted GI upset, typically modest and temporary, but certainly can be a limiting factor. Injection site reactions. Severe reactions are possible, uncommon, but things like pancreatitis or gallbladder disease are rarely associated with this class. And we do, in fairness, have things we're continuing to learn about. For example, FDA recently released an analysis that looked at reports of suicidal thoughts and actions in patients with GLP-1 agonist. They didn't confirm a link there, but there is ongoing monitoring. So there are things that we need to stay tuned and be abreast of as data emerges. But I want to talk a little bit about the GI side effects first. And Andrea and Craig, I'd love your thoughts here. Perhaps some practical tips that we could share with patients for mitigating those GI side effects when we start. And we've mentioned starting low and going slow. But do you have other things, Andrea, that you suggest with patients?
That's a great question. So we often talk a little bit about how these medications work and how patients might just need to adjust their normal dietary habits. As we said earlier in the webinar, managing diabetes is not just about which medication we give to patients, but how we help them manage all of the other things that impact their disease process. So things like, are you eating smaller meals? perhaps listening to your hunger cues a little bit more closely, particularly if you've noted some GI upset with any medications that you've been taking. And we will occasionally utilize things like ondansetron to help relieve that mild nausea. I'm curious if Craig has noticed that his patients tend to complain of these symptoms more frequently on the day of dosing rather than later in the week. That's what I've noticed with most of my patients. So if they do need to use something like an ondansetron, it typically is just for that day of injection, and then they seem to improve over the course of the following 5 to 6 days.
Yeah, no, it is definitely a benefit of the weekly injections, that it is not a for the whole week you kind of feel the same. So it is definitely worse. And that does kind of fit. You know, this is not something that kind of slowly leaks in the system over the first 3 or 4 days. You kind of get some peaks, and then most of them have half-lives measured in days, which is why we can dose them once per week. But those first couple days in your weekly dosing cycle of it are going to be a bit worse. So, and yeah, we are not opposed certainly to using some symptomatic management medications if it helps patients.
But let's move along now to the SGLT2 inhibitors. We have 6 agents within this class. 5 of these are approved for management of type 2 diabetes, in addition to other indications around reducing. Some of them have additional indications for reducing cardiovascular risk. The kind of the outlier here is sotagliflozin. It is not approved for managing type 2 diabetes, but it's approved solely for reduction of CV risk. But the other 5 agents, the bexagliflozin, canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, empagliflozin, and ertugliflozin are all approved for type 2 diabetes with potentially other indications folded in there. And Craig, thinking again mechanistically, if we're talking about the mechanism of blood glucose lowering for management of type 2 diabetes, could you step us through that briefly?
Yeah, no, on this one we can kind of sum up. We still debate if there's anything else these might do, but you know, the 99% of what they do is just inhibit reabsorption of glucose in the glomerulus. So we're helping the kidney kind of flush out that excess glucose. And whether you first got this training in pharmacy school or medical school or nursing school, we all learned at one point that the kidney basically reabsorbs most all of the glucose that is filtered. So glucose is freely filtered at the glomerulus. If your blood sugar is 120, concentration ultrafiltrate is 120 milligrams per deciliter. But you very avidly reabsorb that, and it makes sense. We want to basically hang on to our glucose from an evolutionary standpoint. We are built to conserve glucose. But when it gets high enough, now you overwhelm those receptors and it starts spilling out. But there was among the receptors you use to reabsorb that is this receptor. And so by inhibiting this, we basically help that excess glucose just flush out of the system.
Okay, that's a very nice picture, and I think that helps us kind of wrap our heads around how these drugs are working for type 2 diabetes. We do have, as you noted earlier, lots of cardiovascular outcomes data with this drug class as well. So I wondered if you would talk to us about that.
So in fact, you know, if you asked me to pick what is the most impressive kind of outcome from these drugs in the now almost decade we have in the market, it's the kidney benefits. Really does somewhat stand out with heart failure benefit kind of close behind. And then the vascular benefit besides heart failure, so the MI reduction and myocardial infarction and stroke risk, not quite as impressive from a magnitude standpoint.
Okay. Well, Andrea, I want to ask you, as we think about these drugs, we're faced with lots of great benefits that Craig has summarized for us, but we are faced with practical limitations in terms of adverse effects. And what are some of those things that you're navigating through in your practice with patients in terms of limitations of these drugs?
Sure. Most recently, I've had to help a patient understand that just because she's on her medication for her diabetes and chronic kidney disease, and her glucoses are terrific, that doesn't mean she can liberalize her diet, because the mechanism of action is that she is urinating out more glucose and she is giving herself urinary tract infections and candidal infections. So it's been kind of an interesting discussion with her to basically be like, look, you need to still follow the dietary modifications. Urinary related issues are some of the biggest that I've seen here. I've also had some challenges with a couple of patients who we had on loop diuretics, and these medications reduce the dose or stop the loop diuretic, but because of auto prescriptions, they received another prescription for a loop diuretic and then resumed them and resulted in some substantial changes in renal function because they were being over-diuresed. And we've had to kind of reiterate with people that, you know, when we do stop these medications, we want you to stop them regardless of whether or not they get sent to you or somebody calls you and says, hey, we've noticed you haven't filled your prescription. So those are some of the more recent challenges that we've run into here.
The other thing I think you have coming, Jeff, is the ketoacidosis has been an interesting thing that we've kind of had to navigate our way around in practice. And then we'll spend some time on that. But aside from that, it's really some thought about acute kidney injury. And that is, you know, keep in mind if they're already on a diuretic. And then as Andrew said, the urinary tract infections, which, you know, definitely yeast infections in our female patients, whether or not you really increase bacterial cystitis and pyelonephritis risk, the literature still debates that. It's in the labeling and we should be aware of it. And if someone wasn't having any UTIs before their SGLT2 and now they are, absolutely it could do it. But increasing it seems like the risk really is local yeast infections, definitely. And we still kind of debate in the labelings and kind of not clear, is there a really difference between placebo and the drug? Because, you know, patients with diabetes have glucose in their urine already. Now they have more. So it's a little hard to tease out the real UTI risk, but absolutely possible by the mechanism.
Okay, well, let's dig into that ketoacidosis point for just a minute, Craig, as we wrap things up. In our content, we've emphasized that it is, while it is possible, it is also rare, occurring in less than 0.1% of patients. But the real caveat, I think, is that it obviously can be very serious, potentially life-threatening, and it's easy to miss. These patients may present with a blood glucose that's only modestly elevated, perhaps in the range of 250 to 300. So I would wonder if you could tell me which patients you think, first of all, should not get an SGLT2 inhibitor because of this risk. I think that's the foundational question.
Yeah, it's among our patients with type 2 diabetes, that's a little hard to sort out, but absolutely patients with type 1 diabetes. So okay. Should not really get SGLT2s. But because of the way these drugs work, like they will add some benefit in type 1. I mean, this is not an insulin-dependent mechanism. So anytime blood sugar is high, these drugs are going to help you kind of flush out some of that blood sugar. But yeah, our patients with type 1 diabetes are certainly where the vast risk of ketoacidosis comes from. And if they are on a happy dose of insulin that works well for them, and I come along with an SGLT2 for whatever reason, it will slightly decrease their insulin need, and so they might reduce their dose and into a range where they're at risk for ketoacidosis. So really, we should kind of put them out of our mind, in my opinion, for type 1 diabetes. It's a tougher question among our type 2s, who's really at risk, because that it's so rare, it's been really difficult for us to really sort that out at the clinical level.
Okay. Well, I want to quickly look at just some practical things that we can tell patients about reducing the risk. If we're using an SGLT2 inhibitor for them, we have some practical tips that we could consider to reduce that risk, such as providing a sick day management plan for patients, encouraging them to hold the SGLT2 inhibitor, perhaps if they're having severe vomiting or diarrhea. Kind of steering away from these drugs for patients, or steering patients away from using a low-carb diet or following a very low-carb diet if they're taking an SGLT2 inhibitor, because they're already in kind of this mild ketotic state. So that might be enough to tip them over to a more overt ketoacidosis. And then appropriately stopping an SGLT2 inhibitor with an event like surgery for the appropriate amount of time, typically 3 to 4 days before, and then resuming once they're eating normally again. Our content we do have a nice resource that has some more tips on managing this ketoacidosis piece and how to manage that if it occurs in our patients that are hospitalized. So I do hope that our listeners will take a look at that resource for some more details there.
We hope you enjoyed and gained practical insights from listening into this discussion. Now that you've listened, pharmacists, physicians, and nurses can receive CE credit. Just log in to your Pharmacist Letter or Prescriber Insights account and look for the title of this podcast in the list of available CE courses. You'll also be able to access and print out additional materials on this topic, like charts and other quick reference tools, from the Pharmacist Letter and Prescriber Insights websites. If you're not yet a Pharmacist Letter or Prescriber Insights subscriber, find out more about our product offerings at trchealthcare.com. Be sure to follow or subscribe, rate, and review this show in your favorite podcast app. Or find this show on YouTube by searching for TRC Healthcare or clicking the link in the show notes. You can also reach out to provide feedback or make suggestions by emailing us at contactus@trchealthcare.com. Thanks for listening to Medication Talk.